Welcome to The Value of Knowing, the podcast where we dive deep into the world of legal complexity and opportunity on the vibrant continent of Africa. Stay tuned for expert insights and a closer look at the legal landscape in Africa, where Bowmans helps its clients to manage legal complexity and unlock opportunity. That's The Value of Knowing.
This is the second in our series of what directors need to know, particularly about employment law and employment generally. In our first episode, we dealt with what directors should know or needed to know in the ordinary course of business relating to employment and their employees, and we referred to six key themes that come out of the King Code of Corporate Governance and how that impacted on directors. So in this episode, we're going to turn our attention to what a board does when things go wrong. I'm Chris Todd. I'm a partner at Bowmans, and I'm once again going to be talking to Graham Demant. He's a very senior lawyer in our practice who's been providing advice to boards of directors on these issues for many years. Graham, one of the things that's always interested me is that as you go up this corporate food chain, if I can call it that, the stakes get that much higher. And that's not because people further down the food chain, employees employed in far-reaching or less wide-spanning jobs, aren't very important and their needs and interests are very important. But when you get up and around the boardroom and when you get to dealing with problems with chief executives, the stakes are just that much higher. And if you get things wrong and manage things badly, that can have very adverse consequences for a company. And I suppose conversely, if you get things right, and you've got a good playbook for dealing with difficult problems at this level, that's something of huge value to a company. I imagine, Graham, that's why you get called in. It's a great point to turn to you on. What are the issues that cause a board to come and say, please come and help us?
Thanks, Chris. Yeah. In most instances, we get called in where there are allegations that are being made involving alleged misconduct by the chief executive. Now, these allegations could be surfaced through the company's whistleblowing policy, or it could come through the usual grievance policies, or unfortunately, sometimes it is when allegations are being surfaced in the media. We may also be called in where there are allegations involving conduct by senior executives that will negatively impact the company's reputation or could have a regulatory consequence for the company. We are also called in sometimes when the company is failing to perform and the board holds the chief executive accountable for that failure and is considering the dismissal of the chief executive.
Right, so you're sketching, as I'm hearing it, Graham, a series of circumstances where the board would or should be worried. We sometimes talk about what the things are that are keeping the board awake at night. So these are problems, not saying my manager's being rude to me or those kinds of grievances. These are grievances where a board is going to stand up and say, wow, we better deal with this properly. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah. But there are also, you know, there are other circumstances where we called in before a kind of crisis erupts and you've got to deal with things like dismissal or dealing with a particular reputational issue. So I'm currently involved in a matter where there's an issue between the board and the chief executive as to what constitutes an operational issue and what constitutes governance issues by the board. So what is happening is that the board is looking for information from the chief executive in order that it discharges its duties in order to deal with any risk. It's wanting that information to be presented in a particular manner, and the chief executive is pushing back and saying that the manner in which he presents it is up to him, that that's an operational issue, and I'm busy trying to provide guidance to resolve this kind of conflict that exists between the board and the chief executive.
Okay, so you raise an important question. It sounds to me about alignment between the board and the chief executive on what their responsibilities are. What happens when the board are unhappy, when they actually think that the chief executive has done something seriously wrong, or maybe through one of those channels you mentioned just now, whistleblowing line or something of that kind, there is an allegation that it's the chief executive who's actually the person who's causing the problem or who's done something wrong?
So in those instances, what we generally find is that an allegation is being made against the chief executive, but the board doesn't have all the facts that have given rise to that allegation. in most instances, what we find is that the board needs to engage somebody to investigate those facts. What is important is that the board does not adopt a kind of defensive stance and immediately start saying that this hasn't happened, but rather states that it'll investigate the allegations and take the appropriate action if it's warranted.
It sounds to me like you're talking about your public stance, because no doubt when there's a complaint about a chief executive, that can cause serious ripples or ructions both inside the company and outside. So I'm hearing you talk about what messaging the board communicates internally and externally, if necessary, about what's going on.
That's correct, yeah. So, you know, very often these allegations are in the public domain, and it is necessary then to basically state to the shareholders or the stakeholders as to what conduct and what attitude the board is going to adopt to those allegations. And there, as I state, my view is don't take a defensive stance, take one that we will investigate the facts, we will take appropriate action if it's warranted.
Okay, so we'll investigate the facts. That sounds like a good lawyer's thing that lawyers understand. I can't make good decisions unless I understand as much as possible about what's given rise to the issue in the first place. So how do you do that? How does a board get its head around the facts?
Look, it's not generally appropriate to ask an employee in the organization to conduct that investigation because they're subordinate to the chief executive and there are going to be suggestions that they can't do their job properly or fairly in those particular circumstances. So what we tend to find is that in most instances, the investigation will be conducted by lawyers. In some cases, you might have a board member who has both the requisite skills and the time in order to conduct that investigation, in which event that investigation could be conducted by a board member. But most often, lawyers are called in to conduct it. In some instances, the facts require the services of either a forensic investigation or the use of accountants. And in those instances, you know, expert forensics or accountants may be called in. Most often, the engagement of those forensic experts and accountants is done through the lawyers. And that is in order to try and secure, to the extent that you can, legal privilege in relation to the findings of that investigation.
Graham, these are tough times, not only for the board, but for the chief executive, I would think, because you've just described a scenario in which allegations have been made, channeled to a company, perhaps through a whistleblower line. The board has said, perhaps proactively, like you suggest, look, we've had this allegation, if they need to, and we're going to get on top of the facts and make good decisions about it. But what does the CEO do in the meantime? I mean, that by itself can cause major reputational harm, the fact of an investigation. And can they run the business? Can they do their job while this is all going on?
It is difficult, and I've seen the consequences of these kind of allegations and the stress and anxiety it causes and the disruption to a business that it causes. So one of the first issues that the board has to decide is whether the CEO should be suspended pending the outcome of that investigation. But now, suspension of a CEO has to be very, very carefully considered because it can have very negative consequences for the CEO. It can create a perception of guilt. If the company is listed, you've got to announce a suspension. And what we tend to find is that many types of the complaints that we see are very broad and are with very few facts to sustain them. So typically, I've seen allegations of things like racism or corruption or nepotism or favoritism. And these are just broadly made without any facts to substantiate. Now, in that case, I don't think suspension would be warranted at all. If, however, a particular fact is put forward which looks plausible and looks sufficiently serious, then it may be that the board takes a view that it cannot risk having the chief executive in the organization pending the outcome of the investigation, and it may be obliged in those circumstances to suspend. It is possible to deal with the kind of reputational problems by agreeing with the chief executive that he would take leave in order to clear his name or pending the outcome of an investigation, something along those lines that would position it a bit more softly than a suspension being announced to the public or to the organization as a whole.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, Graham, I mean, the kinds of allegations you mentioned, racism, corruption, nepotism, you're not suggesting those aren't serious allegations, but the point is, if they're broadly stated without any particularity, it might be an overreaction to say, we've got a serious problem that this executive can't be in their chair while we look at it.
It is correct. And I mean, I've had exactly that with a very senior executive of a public company where allegations were made that he was engaged in discrimination against women and was engaged in an affair with a female employee. There was no substance or facts provided to substantiate it. If we had suspended, it would have damaged his reputation. At the end of the day, the investigation was conducted and there was no merit to any of the complaints. But had we suspended in those circumstances, we probably would have ended the relationship.
Okay, so there's a difficult judgment call there because on the one hand, you can't say because there's not enough particularity, these complaints are not serious. But on the other, you don't want to allow essentially a ne'er-do-well employee or outsider to sort of lob a grenade in through the whistleblowing system and paralyze the company because broad-ranging but ultimately meritless allegations are made.
That's correct.
So let's just ask this one. If the board's view on the situation is that it is appropriate to get the CEO to sort of step back while this is looked at or sorted out, you've mentioned suspension and then you talked about alternatively the CEO may say, look, let me step back and take a period of special leave while you look at this. I understand you need to. Please look at it quickly. Either way, do we need to talk about hearings, the Latin word, audi alteram partem? Surprising number of people who haven't studied Latin know about that and know that generally you shouldn't take any action that affects an employee without actually hearing them out first.
Yeah, there used to be a requirement that an employee who was to be suspended should be given a hearing before suspension. And that hearing would not be about the merits of the case, but should be as to why or why not the person should be suspended. The Constitutional Court then held that this was not actually required. My view is that given the seniority of a CEO and the impact it will have on reputation and on the organization and on his credibility, that I would at the very least engage with the CEO as to why the board believes it's necessary to suspend, and I would engage with him on ways to mitigate any reputational harm. So exploring with him, is it possible to take special leave pending the outcome of an investigation? Something along those lines.
So that sounds like a conversation. What we talk about in general, the obligation to hear employees out, I think the labor courts described it as an opportunity for dialogue and discussion before taking a decision. Sounds to me that that's the kind of standard that you're suggesting before a decision is taken that could have far-reaching consequences for an executive.
Correct. That's my view.
We're now conducting an investigation, and I suppose it's probably important for us to say, and this is something of a dilemma, Graham. We've looked at the possibility that employees a complaint may be very widely formulated, difficult to get to the bottom of, and may potentially not have merit. At the same time, we can't understate the seriousness if it does have merit. So there's a critical point at which a board has to say, wow, this would be very serious if it were so, but we need the facts before we can take good decisions. So that's the investigation piece you've described.
Correct.
What happens if we find the CEO has done something wrong or seriously wrong? And of course, we mustn't forget that middle area where board members may reasonably take a different view on how serious the problem is.
If the investigation has revealed that there are facts that support an allegation of misconduct, then what would ordinarily be necessary is to hold a disciplinary inquiry. Now, what the board needs to do is to establish what policies apply to discipline in order to establish the degree of formality that is required of the process to be followed. Because our courts have been trying to encourage a move away from the formal criminal type of proceedings to a less formal approach. But many companies have retained that old-style formal process in their disciplinary codes. And many companies have made these contractually binding in their contracts of employment by either incorporating the policies into the contract or stating that if discipline is to be taken, it will be in accordance with the disciplinary code. So in that event, if you find that you've got one of those very formal disciplinary style processes, then a formal inquiry will need to be convened.
So by a formal inquiry, I mean, and you refer to sort of criminal style inquiries. There are plenty of company policies or practices that still refer to prosecutors and charges and things of that kind, all of which are kind of language reminiscent of criminal court. So we're not dealing with a criminal matter. is there any reason why we should be following that kind of criminal procedure?
Only if your disciplinary code and procedure actually requires it. So, you know, I've seen many, many of these disciplinary codes that still retain the old style talk of a prosecution, charges, a hearing, a chairman, a finding, an appeal, all of that kind of processes. So if you do have that, and it is contractually binding, then you are going to be obliged to follow that kind of process. Otherwise, you'd be, you know, if you don't have that formal process, you could adopt a less formal process, which we can talk about just now.
Well, Grab, isn't the message to boards, certainly the one I would be hearing, is if you have got that kind of policy or contract, you should be changing it. Don't carry on with it. Get it into something a bit more modern and consistent with what the labor courts and current kind of employment community thinks is appropriate to deal with complaints about conduct.
Absolutely. And last time we talked about contracting with the chief executive and the importance of the contractual provisions. And there, what you don't want is to have this kind of formal process incorporated into your contract, either by reference to policies or by reference to the code itself. And of course, I would suggest amend your code to align with current thinking in relation to disciplinary codes.
Sitting from the perspective of the board, I can think of nothing worse at all from a governance perspective and from my ability to operate as the kind of controlling mind of the company than having my chief executive as an accused in some sort of public tribunal in which sort of everybody internally or externally is peering over the shoulders to see what lurid detail comes out next, all the while waiting to see, you know, who's going to be running the company. It just doesn't sound very attractive from a board point of view. It sounds to me like this is something which we would want to deal with firmly, fairly, on good information, but confidentially and quickly.
Because of this requirement and the formality required, what we find is that very often boards will consider concluding a mutual separation agreement with the chief executive rather than running the process. So very often, and in fact, most of my CEO departures that I've dealt with have been dealt with by way of mutual separation agreements.
Well, what's in that for the chief executive? In other words, I could see what's in it for the board. The board says, well, actually, we've come to a point where we can go through some sort of elaborate procedure to find out if some third party recommends to us that you should be fired. But on the face of it, on the facts currently available to us, it looks like you should go. Can I say that to the chief executive? And we should be talking about the terms on which that should happen.
So look, very often that conversation happens. So in the background, there is going to be the disciplinary process if there's not a mutual separation. But there's often a conversation had between a trusted advisor or the chairperson of the board with the chief executive about whether, as an alternative to the disciplinary process, a mutual separation would not be more appropriate. And then it's a question of terms. And for the chief executive, it's then a resignation. It's not a dismissal, which obviously is very important going forward in terms of reputation and ability to get a job. And then very often it's the financial terms that need to be discussed as well as to how much are you going to pay over and above the sort of notice or traditional notice period in order to secure a mutual separation agreement.
I've recently been asked by staffers in a public institution whose governing body, its board, decided to pay a very handsome separation package to a chief executive who didn't appear to deserve it on any reasonable assessment of the reasons why or what had gone wrong. And I had members of staff saying, but, you know, how can you ever justify paying this amount to somebody who did that?
I think there are very good grounds for justifying separation payments when you can talk about how much and what you would ordinarily pay in due course. But there are cases where it's not appropriate to enter into any form of settlement agreement that involves a payment to an executive because you're under intense public scrutiny. So an organization, for instance, if you're dealing with allegations of sexual harassment or discrimination, you can be accused of covering up that conduct if you then proceed to a mutual separation agreement. Or you can be accused of rewarding conduct. So somebody's accused of sexual harassment or of, as I say, discriminatory behavior, and then you pay a huge sum of money and then you're accused of rewarding that behavior. So there's a fine balance between the payment for somebody to go and then accusations that you have gone and rewarded somebody for poor conduct.
So there seem to be two things going on there, actually. And as I understand, some of the most serious criticisms that have been directed against lawyers who've helped companies draft separation agreements in certain circumstances are what might be described as kind of hush clauses, or clauses that seek to silence or prevent any scrutiny of conduct that, from a public perspective, might be thought should be subject to public scrutiny. And you've used an example of sexual harassment or something like that. So I think we know of lawyers in the UK that have been heavily criticized for the formulation of legal provisions which essentially seek to stifle access to information. But separately, the straight commercial deal here, I mean, in the question that came to me, staff were talking to me and saying, how could you ever justify paying that person that? They don't deserve it. The flip side of that, well, what is it worth to the institution to actually move on from having that bad apple, if I could use that sort of analogy? So if the chief executive is bad for the company, is causing harm, is damaging, then perhaps is it fair to say then a payment might be warranted that's proportionate to the value to the company of getting rid of them rather than what they somehow personally deserve?
So look, there are two different themes then. I just want to pick up on the payments that are made to the chief executive, so and payments that may be made to a complainant. So what had happened in the past in a number of cases, you've got a very high-profile, very successful chief executive, and an allegation of sexual harassment is made against that chief executive. The company doesn't want to lose that person because of their expertise and skill and the value they add to the organization. And what has then happened is agreements are then entered into with the complainants to leave the company and to drop the allegation of sexual harassment and to stay silent. Now, those are the kind of contracts that your lawyers have got into trouble for. So paying the complainant in order to save the chief executive is quite dangerous, particularly if it is then accompanied by a silence clause. Then the second issue is paying the chief executive in circumstances where allegations of misconduct are made. But in every instance, what the board has got to do, it's got to weigh up the cost to the company of a dispute to dismissal. That's not only your legal cost, but you're dealing with the time that the board needs and the members of staff need to spend on the matter, the potential for which there can be disputes about the facts, the fact that it's going to end up in a public forum, and if it's a contested dismissal, that those facts are going to be in the public domain, and you could find very confidential and sensitive information pertaining to the company ending in the domain. So you weigh up all of those factors, and there is an amount that will be paid or should be paid in order to mitigate against having to incur all those kind of costs, inconvenience, risk, publicity, and can be justified, even if the misconduct being alleged is pretty serious. I always believe that there is merit in weighing up those factors and then determining whether a settlement agreement should be concluded that involves some form of payment.
Okay, so sensibly, there should be a potential commercial outcome that mitigates adverse impact to the outgoing chief executive or the chief executive you want out, and that rationally is defensible and in fact maybe wholly defensible from a corporate perspective.
Correct.
Okay, we get that. It sounds to me, Graham, as though the formal tribunal-style disciplinary hearing is the worst option. In other words, you've got preferably an informal dialogue and discussion with a rational agreement. You've got an agreed exit or separation agreement as a sensible, rational alternative. And it's only if you're contractually locked in and there's no rational discussion going on, or for some reason, this is just one of those matters that the company insists on airing whatever has happened or whatever dirty laundry, whatever else has gone on here, that it insists on taking a principled stance and saying, I'm going to subject this conduct to public scrutiny or to the scrutiny of a fully independent sort of hearing type process. So there are reasons maybe why you do get into a formal tribunal style hearing, even if it's quite undesirable in many respects.
Correct. Correct.
I mean, I don't know if you agree with me that it sounds to me as though that's not a great place to be, but there may be reasons why you're there. And if you are there, what happens?
Once you get there and you are in a formal inquiry process, and I agree with you with all of the negatives that are associated with that process, but essentially what then happens is you've got to have somebody who can chair the inquiry and you've got to have somebody who can present the evidence. Your prosecutor, using your analogy with the criminal style trial. So there what you have is the person conducted that investigation usually is the best person to present the evidence, because they've conducted the investigation, they've interviewed the witnesses, they've gathered the documents. They're best placed to present that before a chair of an inquiry.
And who's the judge or the jury?
So here there are various options. So you could have a situation where the whole board sits and listens to the evidence on both sides. But very often what we find is that the board doesn't have the time to set aside and listen to everything. So what they usually do is delegate it to a subcommittee, or in most instances to an outside chairperson with the relevant expertise. So it's either what we find a subcommittee or a chairman ends up chairing these inquiries.
Graham, that raises interesting questions. If you appoint an outsider, senior counsel, a senior lawyer in the profession, or some other senior person who you think is going to make a good decision in a formal inquiry like this, it sounds to me like the board may be abdicating responsibility for the decision and saying, we will do whatever an outsider external to the company decides should be done in this case. Is that the right way for a board to discharge its responsibilities relating to the CEO?
In my view, a board should never, ever sort of delegate the decision-making on whether the CEO is to be dismissed or not to an outside chairperson, because that would be abrogating its responsibility. At the end of the day, the board has to assess the facts that are determined by the chairperson, and it has to decide whether the trust relationship has broken down irreparably. So at best, the chairperson or the subcommittee would be making a recommendation to the full board. The board would need to very, very carefully consider that recommendation. At the end of the day, it must decide, has the trust relationship broken down irreparably, and it must make the decision to terminate the employment.
Okay, I suppose the same point applies if it was a subcommittee. The subcommittee doesn't make a final decision. It's always going to make a recommendation, because it's the board that must decide ultimately whether a CEO should stay or go.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the scenario with a prosecutor and a judge, a kind of formal tribunal style situation. Is there an alternative? I mean, we said earlier that I think both of us suggested that there were quite distinct disadvantages to that quite sort of criminal justice style model, or emulating a formal court style process when you're really dealing with corporate affairs. Is there an alternative for boards to consider if they're permitted by contract, if they haven't snookered themselves by promising a more formal inquiry?
The critical issue and the sort of fundamental principle of law is that the chief executive must be made aware of all the facts and allegations that are made against him or her, and they must be given an opportunity to deal with these. Now, that doesn't have to be by way of formal process. It could be done by way of an exchange of documents, and it can be presented in writing. Or it could be done by whoever chairs the inquiry adopting what we call an inquisitorial approach to the conduct of a hearing, as opposed to the traditional adversarial model that we find in the criminal type investigation or hearing that we discussed.
Well, can we talk about that a bit, an inquisitorial approach? Is it something like a quiz?
It's a bit like a quiz, but it's got a different style and format. So essentially, the chair interviews and questions the witnesses. So in an adversarial system, the chief executive would cross-examine a witness who comes forward. In an inquisitorial system, the chairperson does that cross-examination. And it's for the chairperson, through the inquisitorial method, to determine the facts. So he or she would present the facts to the chief executive and say, this witness has said this, this document says this, now what do you have to say about that? And it adopts an inquisitorial type approach. So it's a simpler system than the adversarial system, where there are witnesses called, there's cross-examination, re-examination, and evidence presented in that method.
Is that still fair? I mean, if you get challenged externally and say you didn't follow a fair process, is that process accepted as fair?
I think it's a fair process. Certainly, if you look at the code that pertains to disciplinary processes that accompanies the LRA, that would certainly be envisaged within that code, that type of inquisitorial system. It would comply with the code. It would give the chief executive an opportunity to hear all the facts that are presented against him, to challenge those facts, to deal with those facts. The only thing that it prevents is the direct cross-examination by the chief executive of a witness who is called to testify.
As I understand the code standard, it's that there must be a proper investigation in which the person whose conduct is under scrutiny has a fair opportunity to make representations. And if that's the standard, then it seems to me that a properly conducted inquisitorial approach would readily, in fact, go beyond merely investigating and listening to the chief executive.
Yeah, correct.
So in either of those kind of approaches, there may be one conclusion, which is that actually there's no merit in all of this, although it's difficult to conceive of why a company would decide to go into a formalized sort of process unless it's an investigation is already pointed in that direction. But let's accept an outcome might be, look, we think that there's been a misunderstanding here, or the CEO has provided a good explanation. But what about the contrary? When whoever's managing, chairing, leading that investigation or that formal hearing or that inquisitorial process concludes that there's a serious problem and that the chief executive has committed some or other form of serious wrongdoing, what happens then?
So then it's an assessment of whether, in the light of those facts and findings, whether the trust relationship has been irreparably destroyed between the board and the chief executive. And if the conclusion is that the trust and confidence is broken down, dismissal is warranted in those circumstances.
Okay, that's the decision you say gets back to the board. The board ultimately decides that.
Correct, yeah.
Okay, so that's when we talk about poor conduct by a chief executive. They've done something which, in common parlance, would be they've done something wrong. What about the kind of situation you postulated earlier, which is where the board is not happy with how the chief executive's leading the business, not happy with the numbers that are coming through, he's not happy with the levels of energy, the public profiles, not happy with some of the more intangible things, not happy that the chief executive is meeting the kind of performance standards that the board expected when they appointed her?
You're right. So poor performance, it can take many forms. And it may be that the company is very performing poorly against its targets and against its peers. It may be that the performance of the company is acceptable, but the CEO's performance of the functions allocated to him is poor. And in some cases, what we found is, though, we're approached on the basis that the performance is poor, but when we analyze the facts, we find that actually the performance is so unreasonable compared to the standard expected of a reasonable CEO that you're dealing either with negligence or dereliction of duties. So, for instance, I was approached in a matter where a company had sustained a 300 million rand fraud that had been perpetrated against it. An investigation had revealed that the controls in the company were inadequate, and it revealed that those controls that were in place to deal with fraud were being breached by the executives on a regular basis. Now, in that instance, we said, look, we're actually not dealing with poor performance here. We're dealing with negligence. We're dealing with dereliction of duties. And it became a misconduct hearing. But if it doesn't go to that particular standard of negligence or dereliction of duties, then you're dealing with a situation of poor performance.
I mean, there's a fine distinction there, Graham. I mean, as I've always understood it, the main distinction between why you would call it poor performance or why you would call it poor conduct or misconduct is whether it's somehow blameworthy, or you can attribute, you know, some sort of blameworthiness to the person responsible. But that in itself is quite a difficult judgment call. So I'm sitting on the board. I might say, look, I'm not sure. We've made big losses. We're not meeting our objectives. And I'm not 100% sure whether it's actually just the chief executive is no good or is underperforming, or whether they're actually doing something seriously wrong that's driving us in this direction. Do I even care? I say, well, look, I don't really mind if it's their fault or if it's just that they're no good. Either way, I want to hear them out and why they think this is happening. Obviously, consider that fairly. And if I'm not happy, then I want them out.
So in those circumstances, unless you've got sort of facts that would illustrate that it's worse than poor performance, it is blameworthy kind of negligence, the deviation from the standard is so unreasonable that you are dealing with a negligence or dereliction, then it's best just to deal with it as a poor performance matter and go through the process required for dealing with a poor performance scenario.
Are there cases where a board has successfully held a CEO accountable for poor performance as opposed to, you know, breaching acceptable standards of conduct?
There have been some cases, and the most significant case is the Bateman-Brereton case, which was a Labour Appeal Court decision many, many years ago, actually, but it still remains the benchmark and the standard for dealing with CEO poor performance to date. And essentially, that case is important because what it said is that you can judge the CEO's performance against the benchmark of the company's performance. So if the company's performing very poorly against its targets, against what it said it would achieve, you can hold the chief executive accountable for poor performance because of the company's poor performance in those circumstances.
Needless to say, I often say I've not met many employees when you say this has gone wrong and on your watch that don't have quite a long list of explanations. And maybe that's a natural thing. When somebody says, Chris, you haven't managed to do A, B, C, D, E, you know, what's the story? It's very unlikely I'm going to say, oh, you're right, I've got nothing to say. I just haven't. I'm more likely to say, yes, I know I was busy with this and I did that as well. And then I did try this, but this person let me down. And there's any number of long explanations that you can get given. And actually, many of them may well be that problems are complex and interlinked. So am I hearing you say that a chief executive, the buck actually stops with the chief executive?
The buck does stop with the chief executive, but it does require, because those answers are often given, you know, poor market conditions, that type of scenario. So you've got to then analyze, well, what is actually the reason for the poor performance? And it can be because of a number of factors. So for instance, it may be you've adopted a poor strategy. Now, that becomes quite complicated because the chief executive recommends a strategy to the board, but the board approves the strategy. So, you know, is the board then equally blameworthy if you've adopted a poor strategy and that's why the company is performing poorly? Now, in my view, the chief executive is more blameworthy than the board for a poor strategy because essentially they have much more detailed information about the company, about how it will succeed. Your non-executives are not engaged to the same degree in the analysis of the business environment and the strategy that should be adopted. So my view, if it's a poor strategy, I think the chief executive can be held accountable. It may be that you've got a good strategy, but it's a poor execution of that strategy. Now, there, I think the chief executive is completely accountable. And it's no use to say, well, it's my executive team, because it's the duty of the chief executive to manage the executive team. And if they're not performing, he's got to deal with it and choose a better executive team. So that's not going to be an excuse. Market conditions, again, there may be a misreading of market conditions, that the executives have misread the market conditions and then accordingly did not plan appropriately around those market conditions, that again, they may be blamed for poor performance in those circumstances. But then there may be events where, you know, the things just way beyond the control of anybody, like COVID. COVID comes along, the company performs poorly. You can't then turn around and say, well, you know, the chief executive is accountable for those circumstances. So what I'm saying essentially is that every poor performance scenario requires a further analysis of what is actually causing that poor performance.
I'm interested in what you said about strategy, Graham, because I assume you're not saying that board members and NEDs can say, well, I approved the strategy, but I don't really know what this company does, and I've never been in the operation, so, you know, I just sign off on whatever's presented to me. I mean, I take it that, I mean, board members must interrogate the strategy and make, they're on the board for a reason, and must make a sensible decision about whether to approve a strategy or not.
Absolutely. No, I'm not suggesting that by any means. You know, the board clearly has to interrogate the strategy, has to understand it, has to understand the business. You know, we talked in the last session about taking reasonably diligent steps to become informed about the business. They have to do so in order to approve the strategy. That's the most fundamental issue.
That's the very question. If ultimately it's a poor strategy, if the strategy tanks and the board says to the CEO, the strategy's tanked, it's no good. The CEO says, yes, but you approved it. That's the point where you're going to say, well, actually, you sold us a lemon, CEO, and we bought into it and we backed you, but it hasn't worked. You're accountable.
Correct. Correct.
All right. So just on a process point of view, you spent quite a lot of time talking about tribunal style hearings and inquisitorial approaches. If I'm not happy with the CEO's performance, what's my process move?
So the usual process for dealing with poor performing employees is that employer has to warn the employee that their performance is unacceptable. They have to put them on terms. They have to give them an opportunity to improve, all of those kind of scenarios. So the question arises, do you have to go through that formal process with the chief executive as well. And this, again, is where the Bateman and Brereton case is so important, because that case said, in the case of a chief executive, you do not have to performance manage the chief executive, and in fact, all other senior executives as well. Those executives have to know the performance standard required of them. They have to know if they're not performing to the requisite standard, and they have to self-correct. It is not for the board to have to correct the performance of the CEO. That is for the CEO to do himself or herself.
We talked last time about CEO pay or executive pay, and you said we've got to keep track of markets and be following overseas trends and all the reasons why there's very high pay for these jobs. I guess that's why you paid the big bucks, is because the assumption is you've got what it takes. You know what's needed, and you've got the skills to execute it, and that's why we pay you a lot. So you don't come along and say, well, I'm not coping, but can you please help me do my job?
That's correct. Absolutely correct.
Okay. All right. We're reliant on that. So we're focusing on the CEO. The CEO hasn't executed the strategy. The company's performance has been poor. The board has looked at all of this and decided they've lost confidence in the CEO's ability to lead the company. What is the process next? Go to an external chairperson, or what do I do?
Going to assume that the company is not contractually bound to follow a particular process. And what we tend to find is that most companies do not have formal processes in the same way that they've got for dealing with misconduct. So when it comes to dealing with poor performance, they don't have the same formality that is required. And I'm assuming that they would not be contractually bound to follow the same criminal model justice type system for dealing with poor performance. And if they have, they should clearly think about changing that. So essentially, in my view, as long as the CEO is presented with the facts on which the company relies to allege that the performance is unacceptable, and this can be done in a written format or it can be presented orally and by way of documents, and is given an opportunity to respond to those facts and to put forward any mitigating factors, I think that that would be sufficient in terms of the Audi that is required for a poor performance type process.
Okay, so we're not looking at a formal tribunal-style hearing. Is there another route as well? Does the company, I mean, we talked earlier about the possibility of discussing an exit, negotiating an exit. Is that also a possibility in a poor performance situation?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, in fact, most poor performance scenarios end up in a mutual separation agreement being concluded. It's more defensible than your kind of misconduct type dismissal, where you may be, in the example that you gave of staff saying, how have you paid so much money for somebody who's committed this kind of misconduct? So in these kind of scenarios, there's far less challenge to a mutual separation payment to a chief executive to part company, where the board has simply lost confidence in the ability of the chief executive to perform to the requisite standard. And in most instances, a mutual separation will be concluded. I've only had one instance where a chief executive refused point blank to accept any accountability for poor performance and to conclude a mutual separation agreement. And unfortunately, it ended up in the CCMA, where eventually, after 2 days of evidence, an agreement was eventually concluded. But that's the exception rather than the rule. And in most instances, we end up doing mutual separation agreements.
You say that case ended up in the CCMA. Is it seriously the case that when a board has finally lost confidence in a CEO and decides to dismiss them, that the CEO can take the company to the CCMA?
Yep. So that's where all your misconduct and poor performance matters end up, despite the fact that the outcome of that particular dispute can have very far-reaching implications. It can run into many, many millions of rands worth of awards. It can end up in a reinstatement potentially. And so it does end up in the CCMA, which is again why we talked about in the last session the importance of the inclusion of an alternative dispute resolution clause. Because again, you don't want all of these issues around the performance of the company being aired in the CCMA, which is a public forum, and then potentially be taken on review and being put into the Labour Court, and then ultimately Labour Appeal Court, and then, ultimately Constitutional Court 8 years later. This is not what you ideally want in a contested poor performance. And again, this sort of points to why you would in most instances look towards conclusion of a mutual separation agreement.
We've talked earlier about the kind of considerations that would lead a company to say, it's in our interests, our stakeholders, ultimately it's in shareholder interest that we exit the CEO on fair commercial terms. That's going to be in our interests. From an executive's point of view, let's just look at it from there, is what they're likely to accept. We talked earlier about the fact they're facing quite severe reputational consequences if they're fired. There may be circumstances where corporates recognize, a bit like football clubs, that the fact that a football manager is fired because the team isn't doing well doesn't necessarily prevent them from getting another gig quite quickly, because there are lots of things that contribute to that performance. So it might be that executives have to see themselves a bit like that and say, well, it wasn't going well running this company, but I've got a great set of skills that can work well for another company. Anyway, what an executive is looking at is, what is my personal financial position? How long am I going to take to get my next gig? And what can I reasonably expect the company to pay? What's going on in their minds? And what do boards need to think about in planning to get an executive to agree to an exit?
What we often find is that the thing that most concerns the executives is that a resignation or a dismissal would result in the forfeiture of their long-term incentive awards and obviously any short-term incentive that they're busy working towards. And what we often find is there's a lot more value locked up in the incentive schemes than there is in any form of a couple of months additional that you may pay. So very often their interest is in securing the awards or the value of the awards that would otherwise would be forfeited on a resignation. So here we need to examine the rules of the various share schemes and to establish whether on a mutual separation, the shares can be allowed to vest pro rata, or there could be a full vesting of those shares, or alternatively, you are willing to compensate by way of a cash payment for the forfeiture of shares if there's no mutual separation provision in those scheme rules. So most deals we do involve the LTIs, the long-term incentive awards, being allowed to vest either on a pro rata or on a full basis, or some form of cash compensation for those awards. If you can't, your scheme doesn't permit it, and you're not willing to fully compensate, then what you're looking at is additional months' remuneration over and above notice pay. So you're going to end up paying a few more months over and above whatever the contractual notice period would be.
Grant, it sounds quite strange to me that an exiting CEO, you're going to say to them, your wealth is going to depend on how successful your successor is. You've driven the share price into the ground. We want you out. But don't worry, if your successor does brilliantly and resuscitates the share price, you'll do very nicely.
There are two sort of methodologies that we find in schemes. So very often what the schemes allow is an immediate cash out of the shares that are allowed to then vest so that you secure your value. You're not in the hands of your successor, where you may be worried not that they're going to actually improve the share price, but they're actually going to make it worse and that you've got no control over that particular performance. Other ones allow vesting in the ordinary course so that they remain in the scheme and they're subject to the performance of the company over the next period of time. And yes, it may end up being better or it may be end up being worse. It is a share scheme, and that's exactly what it's intended to do, is align value with shareholder value.
I heard you say that from the executive's point of view, this is very often a bigger point, and it makes me think that what you're really saying is it's always all about the money for the chief executive. But putting that to one side, or less accepting that may be the case, is there a norm that people should think about in terms of months' pay? You said that's less likely to be important, particularly where there are significant short or long-term incentives. But how do executives think about the money? How many months' pay should I offer a chief executive to go quietly?
The maximum compensation for an unfair dismissal in the CCMA or labor courts is 12 months, unless it's some form of discriminatory dismissal, which often it isn't when you're dealing with the kind of poor performance type scenario. So your maximum is 12 months. Your prospect of reinstatement of a chief executive is not high because of the trust that's required in that particular position. So you're generally dealing with 12 months being your absolute outside in terms of maximum payment. If there are very good and compelling reasons as to why you want the chief executive to go, you're talking between 0 and 6 months over and above notice pay. So anywhere sort of 3 months to 6 months would be the kind of norm. If your arguments are very poor and you've got sort of nebulous arguments about poor performance, you just want the person out, it's no longer a fit, that kind of argument, then you're looking in this sort of 6 to 12 months type terrain over and above notice pay. That's your parameters. It's between 0 and 12 months and anywhere in between. We've seen deals up to 12 months where the facts are pretty poor. I've seen deals where it's only the notice pay and there's a resignation because the facts are particularly strong.
Graham, thank you very much. That's all been very interesting. And I hope listeners who are sitting on boards will be thinking about this. I hope that you don't have to exit the chief executive officer of your organization too frequently, because it sounds complicated and high stakes. I suppose that's why, Graham, you have spent so much time advising boards in these circumstances over your career. But it's been great talking to you. Thanks for this session, and we look forward to next time.
If you would like to get in touch or find out more about Bowmans, please visit bowmanslaw.com.